I love the colorful clothes she wears and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle word on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations.
Welcome to Anniversary. Over the next hour, I'm going to spend time talking to a respected pioneer with true passion and feeling who's guided us through revolutions in her world and ours. No other broadcaster has spent five decades on the same national radio network, befriended and helped as many major music artists, or introduced us to so many good tunes. Annie Nightingale, CBE, has style, mischievousness with a glint in her eye, warm authority and a Guinness World Record for a show that always begins with a banger and a well-known greeting, which I'll give to the Queen of BBC Radio. Hey, hi, hello, Annie Nightingale.
Hey, hi, hello, Zoe.
This is a real treat for me, Annie, can I just say, as someone who has admired you, someone who is so grateful for everything that you've done for women in broadcasting, because you are a pioneer, Annie, but also someone who knows you're a great friend and you have so many incredible stories to share. Our listeners are in for a treat. If we go back to the beginning, your life could have played out very differently indeed, because you went to convent school. And I believe at one point even thought that you might like to be a nun.
Yes, this is absolutely true. I was probably about 8 or 9. I wasn't even a Catholic. I think my parents sent me to this convent school because they turned out nice young ladies who spoke nicely. That was all, not the religious side of it. But I took that on board 100%. And everywhere there were pictures of Jesus and Mary, and we could buy pictures of them like they were pop stars. And so and you buy rosaries and you have holy water. I went for the whole package. I thought it was fantastic. And I was taking it far too seriously, which I think my parents realised that this was not a direction they had intended for me to go. And so I was removed and went to a different school after that. But yes, can you imagine? I'd have been Sister Nightingale. No, Sister Annie or something. No, they were all called Sister Mary something or other.
Yeah, my headmistress at convent school was called Sister Kevin. Imagine how confusing that was for a girl.
Sister Kevin?
Yes.
That is a bit confusing, isn't it?
I know it is.
Absolutely. But you never forget those things. It was a beautiful setting, right on the Thames, and the home of Alexander Pope, the poet. And I had this dream about 2 years ago when Eminem was playing at Twickenham, the big rugby stadium, you know, England, sort of home of rugby. And I thought, what I'd love to do, because to me Eminem's a bit of a poet, so I thought, I'd like to take him on a boat trip up and down the Thames and show him my school. I mean, can you imagine? Yeah, you know, the most famous rapper in the world would really be interested in that. It was just a sort of stupid fantasy, but every now and then I'll get a mad idea and I'll make it happen, but not always. So if anyone's a friend of Eminem and knows when he might come back or when we might see any of our live shows come back, please bear in mind that I like to take him a trip up and down the Thames and show him the home of a poet, because I think he is a kind of poet.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think this is something, Annie, that you have done throughout your career, which we'll talk about, is that you have got pop stars, some of our biggest music stars, to talk to you in a way you've put them at ease. You know, they feel comfortable talking to you, and therefore you've had some incredible access to some of the most amazing musicians in our lifetime. Let's talk about the Beatles. Because you have said that you would not have achieved your desire to be a DJ at Radio 1 without the Beatles and Apple.
Absolutely true. Well, they inspired a generation. And before that, before the Beatles, young people, I think, were encouraged to, when they left school, not many people went to university, I certainly didn't, that you would take on a job, maybe following in your parents' footsteps. And what the Beatles did to me was change all that and go, actually, you can do whatever you like. Give it a go. And they inspired that generation to believe that they could pick up a guitar and become something like they did. Obviously, not everybody did. But a lot of that brought about that youth revolution. And without them to inspire me to believe that I could do what I really wanted to and dreamed of, I'm sure it wouldn't have happened. So that, to me, that's why I'm very grateful to them, even, you know, before I'd met them. And that was just beginning to peak as well, this great big wave of youth revolution and everything that happened at that time in the 60s. And Mick Jagger's even said, we couldn't have done it as the Rolling Stones without the Beatles. So if it's good enough for him, it's certainly good enough for me.
Baby's good to me, you know she's happy as can be, you know she said so. I'm in love with her and I feel fine. Baby says she's mine, you know she tells me all the time, you know she said so.
Tell me about hearing pirate radio and where your love of, you know, why did you want to become a music journalist originally, and why did you want to work in radio?
Well, music journalists came first of all. There wasn't, I mean, we had the BBC. I grew up literally from the first words I ever said, but tried to say was music, which came out of the radio. And it's so long ago, we didn't have TV. So I, you know, music was the powerful force to me as a very small child. But again, I didn't think I'd got any natural talent to play an instrument. And very embarrassing when your real name is Nightingale and you're not a good singer. So where was I going to go with it? But once this kind of great wave of the youth revolution happened, I thought, I feel I want to be part of this. What can I do? How can I be part of this? And so I was writing about pop music. I had a column in the local paper, and at that time, this is in Brighton, and at that time all the bands and all the groups that came up with the Beatles, they would all come and play in Brighton because they were touring all the time, and they would go to all the major cities. And so because I was a journalist, I had access to meet them, and they were all incredibly friendly. I mean, I remember dragging Billy J. Kramer onto the beach to do an interview with him, because I thought it'd be more interesting for him than, you know, sit in some backstage or some dressing room or hotel room. So I obviously had that kind of enough enterprise to do things like that. But I wanted to make it interesting for them, because I realised that people like the Beatles were being asked the same question every single day. So make this interview you're going to do fun for them. Ask something different. And I still believe that to this day. I think they were very open And they were very trusting too of journalists, and probably they were doing 18, 20 interviews wherever they went. So make it fun, make a bit of an impression. And maybe I did, but they trusted me. And so I got to interview them more and more often. But still, radio was the BBC, was the home service, the light programme, the third programme. That's all we had. But we'd had Radio Luxembourg. That completely fired my imagination. But then the pirates, what happened? And again, living in Brighton, I was living on the seafront and listening to Radio Caroline. And suddenly, this ship came along the horizon. And there's me listening to the radio. And they were going, hello, we can see you, Brighton. You know, we're just pulling up or sailing past, steaming past Brighton. And that was my moment. I thought, all I want to do, jump in the sea and swim out and join them. I thought, this is what I want to do, because describing music in words for, you know, a newspaper or magazine was one thing, but you just want to play it to your friend and say, hey, I just heard this, what do you think? And that has never changed. And radio seems to be the way of doing it. Well, then the pirates got outlawed and banned and stopped. And then Radio 1 began so that, you know, the government could say, or the BBC could say, OK, you pop kids want this stuff. Because up till then, we'd never had, you know, back-to-back, wall-to-wall pop music all day long, never. And because of a lot of rules and regulation. So when Radio 1 happened, we thought, well, is it going to be as good as the pirates? Are they going to be, again, stuck with rules and regulations and stuff that you can't do this and you can't play that and whatever? But because now they were on dry land, I could see that maybe there's an opportunity so that I could, you know, I could join Radio 1. And I hadn't realised that there were a lot of barriers to be overcome.
Woman, I can hardly express my mixed emotions at my thoughtlessness. After all, I'm forever in your debt. And woman, I will try to express my inner feeling and thankfulness. For showing me the meaning of success.
When John died, you were hosting a live debate as part of the Whistle Test on Tuesday, the 9th of December in 1980. And live on the show, the producers patched through a caller, and it was Paul, wasn't it? Paul McCartney.
Well, the funniest thing, the weird thing is, the producer said to me, because that was a very difficult show, we'd heard that morning that what had happened, but we didn't know in what the circumstances were. And the producer of the Old Grey Whistle Test, who I was the front person for that at the time, Mike Appleton, said, right, we're going to do a live show tonight as a tribute. So we'll go in the studio. And it was very difficult to get anyone to come in and talk about John, because everyone, the whole nation, the whole world was so shocked. And we didn't know why this had happened or any of the detail. So we did the show live from Television Centre, just of the few people that we could get to talk about him who were not, it's so shell-shocked that they couldn't speak hardly. So we got them in, and then we were playing back an interview which John had done with Bob Harris, I think, actually, from a few years before. And while the tape was playing, Mike came into the studio and said to me, Paul's on the phone, wants to speak to you. And I said, Paul who? Because it just never occurred to me that Paul McCartney, one of the people, you know, in the Beatles, would be actually phoning the studio while we're on live. And I was just like, well, I can't take phone calls in the middle of a live programme. You know, it's ridiculous. So he said, no, it's Paul McCartney. I went, oh, okay. And I think what has happened to him is that he had, I've pieced it all together since then, he had worked all day at Air Studios, which at that time was right near Oxford Circus in London. Because he tried to have, you know, make some sense of it all, and went to work, which some people found a bit shocking. But rather than sit at home and have all the media at him, he went to work and tried to do some recording. Went home, turned on the TV, and heard all these pundits, listened to all these pundits, trying to make sense of it all. And I think he thought that they weren't getting it right or something. Anyway, he obviously had the desire. He hadn't spoken to anybody. I think one interview first thing in that morning, but he hadn't spoken to anyone. The whole world was trying to get hold of him, either him or Yoko. And he chose to call us on that show. And he said, just thank everybody for their good wishes and their condolences and say thank you on behalf of myself, George and Ringo, and mentioned Yoko and Linda, who was Paul's wife at the time. And I went back in front of the camera and I thought, right, you're the messenger. Just deliver this. Look straight in the camera and say what he said. But when it came to saying, you know, Paul, Ringo and George, you think, that's only three Beatles. That's not four anymore. And I think that's when it hit me. But I thought, you've got to hold it together. Be calm, be professional. Because you're live in front of a camera and Paul has just phoned you. So it was quite a moment, yeah.
That's an incredible moment to be part of. My goodness me. Talking with Annie Nightingale, 5 decades of working on the radio, Annie. I mean, you have interviewed some of the greatest musicians. Tell me about Mark Bolan.
Mark was such fun. He was such fun. You know, a lot of people said, well, he had this massive ego. Well, he did, but he didn't mind taking the piss out of himself. And he didn't take himself terribly seriously. And I interviewed him lots of times. He was living in London, and we sat at his house all afternoon, having a drink or two or whatever. Those interviews were huge fun in those days. It was just like, you know, hanging out with a friend. And in fact, it was a friendship. And during that interview, I'd heard about, I'd seen a fantastic coffee table book. I mean, you know, I mean, a very big, expensive, hardback, lovely, very lush kind of book about the composer, songwriter Cole Porter. And we'd been talking about songs and the greatest songs of all time. And he mentioned this book. I went, oh, have you got that book? I said, I really, really want this book. And it was, I remember, it says silver cover. I've still got it. And I said, can I have it for my birthday, please? I was very, what a thing to say to a pop star, demanding. And he said, OK, and he did. He sent me this book for my birthday, which I still got. So, you know, he didn't have to do that. And those kind of moments are very special. So he was huge fun and immensely talented. And I think what he'd be pleased about is that that music of his has really lasted. And I don't think that he possibly would have believed at the time that it would. Because he would say, oh, everyone says, oh, it's amazing you're still going. And he was about 24 at the time. And everyone expected that all these pop stars would sort of have their moment of glory and then they would just fizzle out and that's all over. And that happened probably a lot then. Well, I mean, it still does. But, you know, he was constantly having to prove that he was still there and still a force to be reckoned with. Yeah, I think he would be thrilled to know that that music is still survived very well and that his reputation actually is far greater now and respect for him than it ever was when he was alive. And he thought to be a teeny bop star, but actually he's a very, very good musician and could write amazing songs.
Write it all out like a bird in the sky, words. Write it all out like you were a bird. Fly it all out like an eagle in a sunbeam. Write it all out like you were a bird. Wear a tall hat like a druid in the old days. Wear a tall hat and a tattered gown. Ride a white swan like the people of a bell chain. Wear your hair long, babe, you can't go wrong. Catch a bright star and a place it on your forehead. Say a few spells and baby, there you go. Take a black cat and sit you on your shoulder. And in the morning you'll know all you know.
T-Rex and Ride a White Swan. David Bowie, Annie. I mean, David took many years to get going. He wasn't a success when he was very young. When did you encounter David?
I've known about him being David Jones and the Lower Third. And then he made a record called The Laughing Gnome, which yes. was a real novelty number. But at the time as well, there was a very popular entertainer, singer called Anthony Newley. And David was very influenced by Anthony Newley. And Anthony Newley was actually a very extraordinary and interesting and weird talent who then went on to become working musicals and Broadway and all that sort of thing, away from the sort of pop area. So, but David had this influence of Anthony Newley. So this weird song called The Laughing Gnome, which really was not a thing to launch your career with if you were going to be him. And so it could have sunk him forever. And then he came up with this track called Space Oddity. Now, this is the time of the moon landings. Everyone was very obsessed with space travel and astronauts. And what I loved about it was that it felt so different. It was not a love song. It's about a guy spinning around in space who could maybe, you know, never ever going to get back home, back on Earth. So the subject of the song was very different. But musically, it was using all electronic sound. So it didn't sound like, you know, the kind of pop song at the time. Everything about it was different, was unique. And I thought, this is fantastic. And this is at the time when the Beatles were breaking up, and we didn't know exactly when it was happening. But it was obvious because I was just saying about George wanted to do his thing and John wanted to do his thing with Yoko, and except they were fragmenting. Who was going to take their place? And at the time, all the media were going, right, who's going to be the next Beatles? And everyone assumed that it's going to be a group or a band. And I heard this track, Space Oddity. I thought, this is the way forward. This, it's him. And he was 22, very skinny, and had sort of blonde, frizzy hair, like he'd been permed or something. Not a great look. And I went to see him play, and he was support act to Humble Pie. Again, this is in Brighton, this is where I live. I took him to the pub across the road after the gig and said, you are the future. And I really believed it. And, of course, he was, but it took a long while. I mean, there's another 3 years before he found that persona of Ziggy Stardust. He was struggling to find that identity that he eventually got. And then, of course, he would keep changing it. And from Ziggy Stardust, he, you know, killed that off, and then with the Thin White Duke, and kept on reinventing himself, which was so clever. And he was always ahead of what was happening. And that is why I think we all admired him so much.
This is Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping through the door. Stars look very different today. For here am I sitting in a tin can, far above the world. Planet Earth is blue, and there's nothing
David Bowie and Space Oddity. Annie, you got into television, and it's kind of a wonderful story because you met Dusty Springfield, you knew Dusty Springfield, an incredible performer, and I do believe it was with her that you met the producer Vicky Wickham.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd gone to see Dusty play, and in those days there wasn't so much of a entourage and you know, velvet rope kind of thing. It was much easier. Somehow, I managed to kind of get to see her after the show. I was a huge fan of Dusty. And she said, oh, by the way, this is Vicky Wickham. Now, this is at the time when Ready, Steady, Go has already proved that it was absolutely groundbreaking TV show. And so by now, because I so desperately wanted to be part of this whole pop revolution, I was part managing a band and made a record. And obviously what he wanted was to get your band on Ready Steady Go. So I went, oh, Vicky, just the person I want to meet. Can I tell you about this band? And would you have them play on Ready Steady Go? So she said, well, bring me the record in London and we'll have a listen. So they did. Anyway, they weren't wild about the record, to be honest. But then she said to me, oh, by the way, we're looking for a presenter for a new show, a sort of sister show to Ready, Steady, Go. Would you be interested? Well, what were you said, Zoe? You know, yes, I think so. So that's how I did a part that was absolutely terrifying. And the series was called That's For Me. It was not, to be honest, it did not turn out to be as groundbreaking as Ready, Steady, Go. But because it was the same production people, so I went to Ready, Steady, Go every week. And you'd be in the studio in among the audience, which is all tiny, and the cameras would be rushing through around the studio floor. And if you were in the way, well, that was your bad luck. So you'd have Stevie Wonder right in front of you, or the Supremes right next to you. I mean, literally just a couple of metres away. So it was an extraordinary experience. And to be part of that game was, I felt, a huge privilege. A huge privilege. So I wasn't the journalist who might trip them up or say things they didn't want to hear anymore. Or not to them, I'd become a TV presenter, which is much more acceptable.
When I said I needed you, you said you would always stay. It wasn't me who changed, but you, and now you've gone away. Don't you see that now you've gone, and I'm left here on my own, that I
Springfield, You Don't Have to Say You Love Me. An incredible performer, Annie, and somebody you got to know and hang out with.
I admired her tremendously, and although, as I said, I can't sing, it inspired me to... It's a bit like The X Factor. If we're all honest, we'd all love to do that and be a star and all that. I don't know many people who, if they're really honest, would say, no, I was never interested in any of that. I think we were all a bit starstruck. I certainly was. So as a kind of ruse for a newspaper feature, I said, what would it be like to try and become a pop star? So I got even an audition at Abbey Road to do an audition, a sing. So I sang You Don't Have to Say You Love Me, because I loved Dusty and I loved her voice, and of course, I got turned down, but it was an experience. And I was interested in having those experiences, even though I didn't have, you know, her kind of talent. But I did admire her, and we all needed our heroes. And she remained, right through her life, a huge influence on me. And one of the best singers we've ever had, you know, obviously been later on, like Amy Winehouse. And Celeste right now. So she's not the only one, but at the time, she really stood out to me. And I loved the clothes that she wore. They're just wonderful long dresses with, I don't know, they just look good. and I wanted to dress like her. Yeah, she was just an inspiration for me.
You've met them all along the way, Annie. Incredible. You had the opportunity to meet Bob Marley, to speak with him. This was around the time that Exodus had been released, I believe.
That's correct, yes. It was in the mid-70s. And he was in London, he was recording, and he was staying in a house. And I was invited to go and interview him. And then we must have been in a sort of patio outside. It's hard to remember now, but I have a recording of it. Very badly recorded, because I was doing this as a sort of journalistic enterprise. And he didn't care about the quality of the recording, wasn't important. It was just as an aid memoir when you were, you know, to transcribe it to remember what the person said. So I started talking to him, and then this music, his own music, came blaring out of speakers. He had a lot, he was surrounded by some young ladies, admired. I don't know who they were, I never did find out who they were. So this music that turned out to be classic, fabulous music. In fact, Exodus was named as the album of the century by Time magazine. And so I'm talking to him. His own music is in the background. And he is saying to these girls, turn it down, turn that noise down. Not turn that noise down. Turn that down, turn that. It's too loud. Because he realised that it was drowning out the interview. Because I thought it's, you know, quite hilarious that Bob Marley is telling these people to turn down his own music, which is about to become absolute classic album. And that was a weird interview, because the contrast between him and me, you know, I still spoke in my kind of convent girl, quite posh accent. And he had his very deep Jamaican patois. And so the two of us together, it's quite comic to think about it now. And I got quite news-nice about it at one point. And I was asking him about Rastafarianism and how many wives you were allowed to have and what you could do. And so I was get ultra serious. And when you put it, I listened to it back, it just sounded like I was trying to catch him out. I wasn't at all. I was just being very earnest. I wanted to know more. And I felt that I was not under rehearsed, but yeah, I should have known more about Rastafarianism, but not a lot of people did at the time. And some of the things he couldn't really answer either. But yeah, I always felt I was lecturing him about his way of life. We were both finding our way, in a sense. So, you know, I had the greatest, I mean, one of those tracks, to me, is the happiest piece of music I've ever heard. And if ever I want to cheer myself up or anyone else, I would play this track, because I think it's the most joyous piece of music ever.
Bob Marley and Three Little Birds. I love it, Annie. You were giving Bob Marley a hard time. Fantastic. Annie, let's talk about the old grey whistle test, because you came on board and you manoeuvred perhaps a little bit away from Steely Dan, because musically, this was a really exciting time. There was the Jam. You know, you smuggled the adverts into the studio.
Well, punk was happening, and what had happened in that up until that time in the 70s, was he'd kind of got this, started out being called prog rock, and it could develop into bands playing very, very long guitar solos. And it got self-indulgent, and they got bigger and bigger names, and they became further and further removed from the audience. And what was going on in the country, we were having mass unemployment and strikes and 3-day week and all that. It was a very difficult time. A bit like now, but obviously now is a different set of circumstances. But it was a very tough time. And along came these people who wanted to speak out and say what they really expressed themselves, called punk. And this has not been reflected by the BBC, hardly any on Radio 1. Only John Peel. I mean, John Peel was a great saviour of punk because he played everything. And, you know, he risked being taken off air. I know all his life he was worried about his shows, that the music was, some people thought, was unlistenable. He took a lot of courage to keep playing what he did. So through him, it started to grow. And it was a very DIY culture. And people felt, in funny way, like when the Beatles had started and people thought, oh, I could, you know, pick up a guitar and learn to play or drum kit. And so you had a new generation who believed that as well, but they were not getting the exposure that they needed. And we had two TV programmes then on the BBC. We had Top of the Pops and we had The Old Grey Whistle Test. The Old Grey Whistle Test was more album orientated. And a lot of the punks never got around to making an album. They hadn't got that far. It was difficult enough. Pressure up their own single on their own and design their own artwork and make the sleeves and mail them out by, you know, their own. It was very, very DIY. So I was very aware that the BBC was not reflecting popular culture. And so when I took over presenting the show, it was my intention that we should get a lot more punk onto the show. And we did. Then I thought, but because the show had reflected guitar bands, that a lot of the punk bands maybe would not actually want to be on the show. It might have taken a lot of persuasion whether I had enough credibility as a presenter to be agreeable to them. But most of them did, actually. And it was hugely enjoyable. But it was this, I quite enjoyed that kind of, well, that uphill struggle to get them on TV where they deserved to be. And they hadn't been encouraged to be so. So, yeah, it was a good time.
Looking Through Gary Gilmore's Eyes.
We're talking with Annie Nightingale about her incredible career and some of the musicians who she's championed across the years. Acid House Annie, the 90s again, like the 60s, and an incredible time for new music.
Absolutely. And you couldn't make that comparison at the time. Although I could feel it happening, I could feel, my goodness, this is amazing. And, you know, you were very much at the forefront of all of that too. So you will, you know, you can put me right at any bits of this that I might get wrong. But you felt there was, again, a youth revolution. Something new was happening. And it was quite clear to me straight away that it was happening. Musically, with art, with movies, with books, the whole culture changed. And it was sort of anti the 80s. In the 80s, we'd had yuppies and wine bars. Remember, wine bars, where you expected to buy a bottle of champagne, which is very expensive. And, you know, you had the city boys making lots of money. It's about money. You know, like, as in the Harry Enfield character, loads of money. But some people thought that was for real, you know, somebody boasting about how much money they were making. So the Acid House was a kind of reaction to that culture, which had been very brash and showy-offy about, you know, how much money they were making. And so, again, it became a new underground. And because, again, there were actually not, things were not going very well in the country, even sort of after punk in the 70s, then you'd had the 80s, I'd say the kind of loads of money thing. And then it's the 90s, you know, there's a boom or bust thing that seems to happen here. We were back into the doldrums again. And so people were finding it very hard to get known, to get signed to a record label. And so, again, that sort of the DIY culture took over. Or the small labels took over, like Factory in Manchester and Stiff Records, although that had been a punk label, but the new labels that were championing this new kind of music, independent labels. And I think everyone knows the story of how it began with a group of DJs went on holiday to Ibiza, discovered this mixture of music, which is Spanish guitar music mixed with Chicago house, Detroit techno, and somehow mixing it all together, and it had that holiday feel. And they'd go to a club, it would be open all night, which hadn't happened before, and or certainly hadn't happened here in the UK. And they came home in their holiday shorts and their very bright t-shirts, started doing the same thing here in little tiny clubs in London, and then it spread right round the country very, very quickly. And then we had the huge explosion in Manchester with bands like Happy Mondays, Stone Roses, 808 State. This huge explosion came from Manchester and spread all over the UK. And they were on Top of the Pops all the same week. And I think that's when you realise that something really big was happening. And they were anti-money and anti-capitalist almost. So it was a bit like the 60s, but I didn't dare say so because I thought then people think you're all hippie. And also it wasn't exactly the same, but the DJ suddenly became the star rather than a band, and they would be in the corner somewhere, and they and the audience would all be as one, and they'd have fantastic visuals. And you could turn any empty building, an old warehouse, empty house, magically, and you'd have UV lights, and you could change that and make it immersive so that you could take people on this sort of fantastic voyage into the unknown with this wonderful music that came from white label vinyl that the public couldn't buy them because they didn't know where to go. But it took over everything. It's very friendly. So where you'd had football rival fans having fights and being very violent, suddenly everyone became friends, and it was very democratising you know, if you went to a rave, and it was just a rave out in a field in the country, and, you know, if the person next to you was a duke of somewhere or aristocratic, and you're a plumber, you make friends. So it did that from a social point of view, which I think is very important.
Mondays and hallelujah. Annie, you have done it all. You have been a pioneer both on the radio and on the television. You've made it possible for, you know, women like me to get work. You've inspired us all. And I know it's not so much for you about being a woman in the job that you do, but you did change things. It was a very male-dominated world and you changed all of that. Also, you have brought so much music into people's lives on the radio and on the television shows, on the Radio 1 Request Show. Also, you know, your shows you continue to do 50 years on Radio 1. I mean, it's an incredible thing. You received an MBE, now a CBE. It's so exciting. I've heard you've got to find the award to return it in order to get the other one.
It's a bit embarrassing. So suddenly I got this scroll. I mean, not a letter, not an email, but a real scroll in a cardboard tube from Buckingham Palace saying... Because obviously all these investitures have not happened this year for most people who've been given any of these honours because of the pandemic. And so I haven't got the CBE yet. But so this scroll from Buckingham Palace said, you need to send back your MBE so we can sort of swap it over. What they do with them, I don't know, melt them down or I've no idea. And then I thought, right, I've hidden it at home and I'm a hoarder. So... I've hidden it somewhere that would be really safe. Where? I haven't lost it, but can I? I have actually now managed to find it, but I still haven't sent it back. But so, as I say, it quite amused me. You get the upgrade, but you've got to give back the original.
Annie, you are wonderful. In 50 years, you have got behind so many artists. You still continue to champion new music. You interviewed Billie Eilish recently. I mean, she's a phenomenal young woman.
I think she is. I think she's once in a generation artist, her and her brother Phineas. They grew up listening, funnily enough, to the Beatles. And they say the Beatles were a big influence on them. And they were homeschooled. I think their story is quite fantastic. Because although they grew up in LA, and we all think of LA as being Hollywood, but they were quite a modest family. They didn't have money, and their parents homeschooled them, but let them do what they, you know, spend time on what they were good at, what they wanted to do, which was music. So Phineas was able to write music. Billy loved dancing and music and directing videos. And so their parents encouraged them to do that by homeschooling them. They could take them to special courses. They went to a lot of classical concerts. They got scholarships to do music. So we don't do that much in the UK, but I'm actually fascinated to know how that's enabled Billy to become such a huge star. 19 now, I think, or about to be. And at 14... she and Phineas recorded this song at their home called Ocean Eyes and put it on SoundCloud and just thought that was the end of that, and then went to sleep in their rooms in their house. Normal night. Woke up in the morning, and 1,000 people had liked it, and they thought, well, this is very weird. We don't know 1,000 people. How come? Now, one of those 1,000 people turned out to be Danny, who turned out to be their manager. And then she was only 14 then. And so she's been managed very carefully. It hasn't happened overnight. None of these successes ever do. So very carefully, over four years or so, her career and Phineas have been nurtured very, very well, I have to say, I think. Until now, she's extraordinary ability to connect with 13, 14-year-olds and also adults understanding what a grown-up talent she has. I mean, to be invited to do the James Bond theme, which usually happens to people of very established artists like Shirley Bassey, Paul McCartney, etc. All the people who've done James Bond theme have never, I don't think, been teenagers before. So, and to be able to fall into that role and get that right and have number one all over the world, she's exceptional talent, but it's her empathy and she connects with people all the time, and that is the magic, I think. And wearing the clothes she does, which now apparently one of my ex-colleagues and very good friend who's now living in China said all the young girls in China dress like Billie Eilish. So she's made a statement of saying, if you're a teenager and you feel embarrassed about your body, you do not have to wear skimpy clothes and low-cut and sexualized clothes. And that, I think, is a great thing that she's done as well. And she's saying, though, you don't think you have to copy me. Do what you want. You know, if you feel confident with your body, by all means, be as sexualized as you like. She's made a big difference for young teenage girls and adolescent girls, as well as that having that amazing voice. So she really is an extraordinary figure in this generation. Really, absolutely extraordinary.
White shirt, now red, my bloody nose sleeping. You're on your tippy toes creeping. Look round like no one knows. Think you're so criminal. Bruises on both my knees for you. Don't say thank you. Oh, please, I do what I want when I'm wanting to. My soul, so cynical. So you're a tough guy, like you're really rough guy. Just can't get enough guy, just always so puff guy. I'm that bad type, make your mama sad type. Make your girlfriend mad type, might seduce your dad type. I'm the bad guy.
Duh.
Billie Eilish and Bad Guy. Annie, what an incredible career. What have you learned in your incredible career? I heard a really lovely thing that with Vicky Wickham, you'd said to her that you were indebted to her for, you know, giving you a break into television and something about passing it on.
I said to Vicky, you know, I will never forget what you did for me. And she said, OK, pass it on. And that is that simple. So, yeah, you try and do that for other people, hand it on. Sort of, you know, if you think somebody has got some ability and needs a bit of an introduction or a play on Radio 1 or something like that, obviously you can't help everybody. And if it's a step on the ladder, I mean, you would know that, that getting your record played on the radio is a big step for people. And it can help them because they can go, oh, my record's been played on Radio 1 or Radio 2 or 6 Music or whatever. And that helps them to get on. Well, then that is what we do for a job anyway. So if it helps them, that is how I pass it on. But you can't help everybody, obviously. But I think that is a good lesson. And I get the buzz out of that. I get incredibly enthusiastic if I feel, wow, here's somebody, this is really good. And then it has the approval of the public because it's no use me going, ah, this is fabulous, blah, and nobody else likes it. Then I've got it wrong. And you don't get it right all the time. So it's that resonating, connecting with the public, the media playing public. And that is why I wanted to be in radio, because somehow you could write about music in print, but you could only describe it. You could play it to somebody, like you're playing it down the phone, and say, hey, I've just heard this tune. What do you think? Do you think it's like validating yourself, really, saying, am I crazy? Am I mad? Is this good? What do you think? And that has never changed over the years. That's why I wanted to be on radio, to be able to share that enthusiasm, to see if I was crazy or not, or whether other people, just share it with people. And that has been my buzz all this time and remains so. It really does. And maybe it's one or two tunes a year that I feel like that's about. Now, they don't always become successful, but that's my role, is to try and get that recognition for them. To me, that is passing it on.
Annie Nightingale, you are a true inspiration. Thank you for the music and the shows, both on the television and the radio. Keep that glint in your eye, girl. Stay golden. You are wonderful.
Thank you, Zoe. So are you.
Thank you so much for talking to us, Annie Nightingale.
Hear my voice.
Many thanks to Annie, who also chose all her favourite tracks for this programme, and thanks to our producer, Mark Simpson.
Hear my words.